K-38 Side 2 has to disarray. Subcommittee 3, April 6, 1979, 8:30 a.m., Room 350, Public Hearing on House Bill 2497.
Subcommittee 3 will come to order. First of all, most of us present, the balance are skewed or delayed, or both. The hearing this morning is on House Bill 2497. Dennis, as far as the scheduling of this is concerned, let's schedule the next hearing on this for the full committee. No, we're present. But for the full committee, and we're present. And as much as we can do that in the rules.
That's fine.
Okay. Elizabeth, would you like to more or less set up your permanent consultant for the benefit of Dennis, who probably knows that the town may not like the staff there work diligently throughout the committee, and the APA subcommittee and legislative council committee is familiar with not only with the language of the act, but also some of the policy decisions that were made by the legislative council committee that underlie this bill. In a quick meeting, you could help take us through the bill.
Oh, I'd be happy to. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Stockdale, Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I assisted the subcommittee of the Legislative Council Committee on the Administrative Procedure Act and its preparation of the bill.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. I have signed up only Mr. Burnfield of the Department of Higher Education to testify. Is anyone else here interested in testifying on the bill? You are? Okay. When the appropriate time comes, will you raise your hand or yell and scream right away? No, that's okay. Go ahead,
Okay, I have brought with me copies of the final report of the subcommittee that are kind of a narrative of the changes that were adopted by the Legislative Council Committee, if it would make it easier for the committee to follow along. We have a kind of a the committee proposed many changes in the Administrative Procedure Act and related statutes, particularly the Legislative Council Committee rule review statutes, and the bill begins with the changes in those statutes. On page 3 of the bill, the major changes that are being made in the rule review are that the dual filing of rules, both a proposed draft of the rule and final version of the rule, have been combined into one filing of the adopted rule with Legislative Council, and that filing has been changed from prior to filing to Secretary of State's office to at any time up to 10 days after the final rule is filed to Secretary of State's office.
Back up completely and let me see that one more time. I must have misunderstood you.
Okay. The way the law reads now, an agency is required to file a proposed draft of any administrative rule that the agency is considering for adoption before it does adopt a rule. And then after adopting, it must file the final adopted version with Legislative Council before it files its final version with the Secretary of State's office. And if the filing order gets confused, then the rule is subject to question for failure to follow procedures properly. The subcommittee recommended and the Legislative Council Committee approved a change to require filing only with Legislative Council a copy of the adopted rule only subsequent to adoption, and gave a lag time of up to 10 days after the final rule was filed with the Secretary of State's office to try to get around the problems that we've had of filing out of order.
What's the sequence then?
Now?
No, the proposed.
The proposed sequence is that an agency can go through the entire rulemaking procedure, and at any time in that rulemaking procedure can file a rule with Legislative Council after its adoption. It can file it before it files with the Secretary of State's office, and the rule becomes effective, or it can file up to 10 days after it files in the Secretary of State's office.
So you're going to loosen up the procedure?
Somewhat, yes.
Somewhat. Isn't this going to give the agencies more leeway?
Well, it's going to, in an attempt to prevent some of the timing problems that have occurred under the way the statute is written now, because many times when an agency adopts a rule, they'll send somebody over to the Capitol building to file it, and they'll stop at the Secretary of State's office first if they come in the front door, and then go to Legislative Council.
Does this generally make it easier for agencies to make rules?
I don't think it'll, no, it won't make it any easier for them to make rules, but the hope is that it'll be less easy for them to foul up their procedure at the very end of the adoption process by inadvertently filing a rule in the wrong office first, which has happened under the existing statute.
Sounds like it's making it easier to me.
Well, the rulemaking process isn't changed by this. We still have to have a copy of the adopted version of the rule. One thing that it does is we have been getting copies of drafts of proposed rules that were never adopted, and we were going through the review process and presenting them to the committee, and then the rules were never adopted. And so that was felt to be something of a waste of time. And then we were presenting many rules with which there was no substantive problem, and the only problem was that the agency had either mailed the rules to both offices on the same day and the mail delivery had been out of sequence, or they had stopped at one office before coming to the other, and that has potentially invalidated the rule the way the statute is. So we're trying to accommodate that problem without removing the requirement of having an adopted rule reviewed by Legislative Council.
Do you really intend to pick on this part of it?
No. We have only had, up to my knowledge, we've only had one inquiry on whether the filing with Legislative Council was properly done. The next thing that's being changed in the rule review is that the requirement that an agency that's required by law to, required by a new statute to adopt rules must file a draft of a proposed rule that's required by that new law within 60 days of the effective date of the requirement. The
which section are you in?
All right, I'm looking at lines 26 to 29 of that page 3 of the draft.
That's the part deleted.
Yes, that's been deleted.
Okay.
So the next major change it will show up on page 4 of the bill, and that is the extent of the review of Legislative Council of any administrative rule submitted under these sections. Under current law, the committee and the Legislative Council staff review the rule for substantive problems, whether or not the proposed rule is within the scope and intent of the legislation enabling it, whether all procedural requirements have been complied with, and whether there are any constitutional issues that are raised that are not raised under the scope and intent.
Page 4, line 5, why is the term legal deleted?
Because the committee felt that that was within the purview of subsection A on lines 1 and 2.
Okay.
So this would reduce the this would remove from the Legislative Council review those procedural items that can only be verified in part by Legislative Council staff, and those are whether the agency gave proper notice, whether the hearing was scheduled within the proper time period after notice was given, whether they prepared a statement of need, whether they filed with Legislative Council prior to filing with the Secretary of State's office. It was felt by the subcommittee that this was a function more properly vested in the Attorney General's Office's counsel for the agency. And so that was removed from the review function of the Legislative Council Committee.
Well, that's going to come out of the same time.
We're on page 4 of the bill. We're talking about the scope of review of the Legislative Council for the initiative rule.
Okay.
Tom, I'll leave it to you to ask whatever questions.
Well,
I'd
like to ask some general questions. First of all, when it comes to rulemaking, I just physically can be. I don't like it. I don't like the administrative agencies. And I think that they've used rulemaking power, and I think the major, one of the major problems in government is rulemaking power. So.
Of course, he's given it to the agencies.
Yeah, well,
that's
I
think
if somebody would take it away, you'd probably get my vote. But this bill, the thrust of this bill to make it easier for agencies to make rules, that's what I have.
Certainly, such, yes. Yeah. But the bill is not was not designed to remove any of the substantive protections that were intended to be provided by the administrative agency.
Does it include any of the substantive protections?
Well, it moves them around a little bit.
Yeah.
I think it does in one respect. Currently, an agency is required to prepare a statement of need for rulemaking, and the agency must keep that statement on file, available for public inspection, and must file a copy of the statement, updated if necessary, when it files the final version of the rule. The committee has recommended that that statement of need be placed in the notice of rulemaking so that it's distributed to a wider group of people instead of someone having to come to an agency office and ask for it. It's right there in the notice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that might be considered to be in the direction that you're talking about.
What's the agency's reaction to France, except it's been generally to the proposal?
To the bill?
Yeah.
Well, we had a lot of testimony from agencies during the hearings of the subcommittee, and most of the agencies seemed to be fairly comfortable with the rulemaking process. They were somewhat troubled by the number of intricate timing relationships between the steps in rulemaking, and that was something that the committee tried to deal with. And one of those was that filing of administrative rules, trying to loosen up that timing so that if they go through the whole process correctly and then foul up on their filing, it wouldn't require them to completely return to step one and start over in the adoption process. There are some amendments in the rule that do give an agency a little more leeway. For example, the bill has a provision that would allow adoption of a temporary rule for a period of 180 days rather than 120.
Thomas, I think if I can explain what I think is what I know is my intention, I think shared by the subcommittee, is not to and make it easier for an agency to do other than what the legislature had intended in the rulemaking process. But what we did try to do was focus on those areas where both the agency and the public could have been frustrated in the past by technical rules of filing and so forth that didn't really make any sense, and that caused a lot of inadvertent filings and inadvertent invalidation rules on which people were relying. And I think that's a fair statement of what the bill does. It's been gone over pretty carefully in that respect.
This is an interim committee?
Yeah, the Legislative Council Committee, of course, is the standing committee of the legislature, and one of the subcommittees that was appointed was subcommittee to take a comprehensive look at the APA. And that subcommittee was appointed of myself, Representative Bugis, and Senator Walt Brown.
Did they look at the whole... Now, there's a movement on the federal level now to reduce the number of rules. I think that's a good movement. Did they look at that?
Well, this is the area in which I teach, and I'm broadly familiar with development on the federal level. And, basically, some of that thinking was brought to bear on what the Oregon Act will look like.
Will this in any way reduce the number of rules that we have?
I don't think
it'll have any measurable effect on that. The number of rules that we have is very proportional to the statutes that we have that require that rules be made. The one respect in which it might make a difference would be found not in this law, except that we recodify it, but rather in the 1977 bill, which required that agencies, before they make rules, file an issue of statement of need for the rules. And what it really does is force the agency to justify in writing on paper why rules are necessary in the first place, the legal authority which requires them, kind of a means and justification for the rule, as to how the rule is expected to meet the need. And that sort of, the task of having to make that kind of justification in itself act as a deterrent to the agency, if it has discretion to make a rule or not make a rule, it might say, well, hell, we don't really need it. So that has, as was pointed out, been transferred from simply something that the agency writes out and puts it in its file drawer to something that it actually has to give notice of to the public when it's
filed to make a public notice.
heard that from Elizabeth, by
the way. Yeah.
The statement of need is part of the...
It's on page 8 of the bill.
Right. Yeah, I find that comment on page 8. Okay. We've expanded considerably the requirements of notice. You know, that has to be given to the public. You find that in lines 13 to 25. That's new language, and I suppose from the standpoint of the point that you've just made, that reinforces it.
Well, that's part of my suspicion, but I just raise the hackles in the back of my neck every time you say rulemaking. Because it's so abused, isn't it?
Well, the scope of this bill is strictly procedural.
After having practiced the law, as a public policy decision, think you could make a very strong argument that it should be very hard procedurally to make the rule. But the fact of making it very hard is that fewer rules will be made. Now, that's a kind of perhaps a roundabout way to enforce public policy, but
I'd rather bite it off directly in the substantive statutory power instead of giving to agencies rather than to the APA itself. But the classic example from the federal APA where certain rules are required to be made on the record after agency hearing has to be based on substantial evidence. And in one rulemaking proceeding, I think the Food and Drug Administration is proposed to increase the peanut content of peanut butter from 85 to 90%. It took 11 years to get the rule. And transcripts of testimony were more than 10,000 pages. And the rule could have been made overnight. And so all that happened was the private parties that had an interest in the rulemaking process ran up enormous claims to the cost of the government was extraordinary. But I think the point to make is one that I think is generally fair. I'm not sure one does it through the procedural mechanism of the APA as opposed to telling the agency when it's going to make the rule.
So, again, one would wonder that. Why were they worried about the peanut content?
Because some federal law told them we had the power to regulate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay. And listen, when we get...
Are you not the only person to...
No, I think we have more than half the interest by the silent people sitting out in the audience, some of whom represent the executive department, some of whom represent students, some of whom represent administration, and I think Kyle Wyatt may have some half the interest in it. So, executive department, State Bar. I'm sure we'll hear from them if we commit some atrocities in the course of the morning. Elizabeth, when we get to the issue of the Department of Higher Education, why don't you flag that for us? So that we can
I will.
Yeah, why don't you pull the mic a little bit closer to you?
I've got a sign here. Don't pull the mic closer.
Oh, right.
Is that better?
Did you want a cup of coffee, by the way, while you're talking?
No, thank you.
Go ahead.
All right, the next step in the change in the bill is page 4, section 5, which is on lines 33 to 38, and down to line 21 on page 5. This is a rewrite of a statute that was adopted or enacted last session that requires public writings, which includes administrative rules, to be written in, quote, plain and simple language, unquote. And the subcommittee received communication that perhaps...
Mr. President, if I may,
yes.
What's an active voice thing? I mean, here, this is in this phrase here, it's in simple language. What's an active voice sentence?
An affirmative statement rather than in a negative or passive.
Why didn't they say affirmative statement?
Well,
active voice
sentence. Different thing. The letter has been mailed by me as opposed to I mailed the letter. You pass the voice off when the action is not identified.
I have this vision of the lay people who come in may look at this. And they're going to wonder what an active voice sentence is.
Well, he should have seen the statute before Elizabeth rewrote it. It was a statute that was passed by the 77 legislature that was supposed to make public writing simple and easy to understand, and it was incomprehensible. So,
I noticed when I was over at the Department of Human Resources that there's a real tendency for an active voice. At first, you know, that.
Giving explanation
to find out why that is. Is it because a rule that feels more
inflated
from the
past
than the
passive? Yeah, I think it's a bureaucratic tendency. If you can use the passive voice to obscure lines of responsibility. And that may be part of it. Or maybe the English classes weren't properly understood by.
Well,
What happens if it isn't in there? What I need isn't in there?
There's no enforcement mechanism.
There's no enforcement mechanism for this?
No.
Okay.
All right, then Section 6 of the bill gets into the revision of the Administrative Procedure Act itself. And beginning with the definitions, the definition of contested case was modified slightly by excluding those agency proceedings in which the decision rests solely on the result of a test. And examples of these kinds of decisions are usually in the case of a licensing board, there will be some kind of written examination before a person can be licensed to practice dentistry or law or medicine or many other professions that are licensed by the state. And the purpose of the amendment was to remove that from the possibility of a formal contested case type of hearing if an applicant wished to request review of the results of the examination.
Would you, under the existing law,
you could ask for a contested case hearing before the agency.
Okay. And under this, what would my report be?
You could ask for reconsideration by the agency that you wouldn't be entitled to a contested case type hearing. So if the agency's order would then be reviewable by the circuit court rather than the court of appeals.
Maybe
a
non-contested case order.
Let's say some major organ industry is going to fight the CDQ over making the CDQ get a test.
It's only when the decision is based solely on a test, and usually in those instances the agency decision is based on more than just a test. Now this could be changed to written examination to make it absolutely clear that it's supposed to apply to the.
Is that what
that's written
in
the written
examination? I believe so. Yeah. The word comes from the federal APA, which excludes proceedings based upon tests, inspections, or what is it?
I think it's just tests and inspections.
Tests and inspections are excluded from federal agency adjudication. And maybe it's a term of art in the federal APA, but I'm not sure how it's been excluded. It's a good point.
Well, what's your analysis of the
DDC
that's coming up? They have tests, but I think they have to find anything that excludes anybody.
It would be my view that that ought to be excluded from the contested case for this. The test ought to mean that. And the reason is that if you look at the Davis and some of the other cases in Minnesota law, but the best way to determine whether or not a person has passed or failed the test is to research the test or inspection and not to use a proceeding which is an adversary adjudicatory fact finding model to redetermine that procedure. But there's nothing to note to take a look under Section 550. It's Title 5, Section 551, I think you find the adjudication. No, sorry, it'd be 554A. You might get Section 9 cases, like A4 or A5. And I can check the FDA if that has ever been subject to discrimination. So, go over this one more time. Making this case, if it becomes a non-contested case, then where is the recourse?
You have recourse with the agency, and if the agency refuses to reconsider or comes up with the same response, then the judicial review would be in the circuit court.
This contested case is for the court of appeals and recognized before the agency. If what you have is an order by the agency, but not an order that's the outcome of the contested case, i.e. an order that says you flunk, then you go to circuit court, and the circuit court makes the record de novo. So that's the procedural difference, as it were, the contested case order as opposed to any other agency order.
Okay. Seems a little slow on this.
That's fine. We've got 9 months of tackling with all this language on this side, so I'm understanding perfectly. Okay, on page 6, the definition of order beginning on line 4. some of the changes are an attempt to just reorganize the existing language so that it's a little clearer what it meant. Most of it all ran together and weren't sure whether order included something or didn't. So the rewrite is an attempt to clarify that. The substantive changes on line 13, 14, and 15, where the statute has been amended to provide that an order does not include a tentative or preliminary agency declaration or statement that precedes final action or does not preclude further agency consideration of the subject matter of the statement or declaration. This was a result of a request, or at least a complaint by the Department of Environmental Quality that in their process, when, for example, a substance issued disposal permit applications, and someone requests a variance, preliminary determinations made by the department based on the application without any hearing or any other findings, and then the applicant is permitted to have a hearing before a variance officer, and I believe even the variance officer's determination is appealable to the Environmental Quality Commission, and they have had premature appeals from either the variance officer's order or the written communication from the first person who received the application pulled into circuit court. So this language is an attempt to clarify that any preliminary determination after which subsequent agency action considering the same problem can be had, that it's not a final order that is subject to appeal in the circuit court.
This is something else about two points when the whole question of the order. And the subsection C down in line 15 may have answered the question, but in line 6, we define order to include any agency determination or decision issued in connection with a contested proceeding. Is that implicitly modified by the word final that appears in line 4?
Yeah.
In contested case, an agency would be making a statement with respect to the discovery rights of the party. That's not something that you can feel on an interlocutory basis on the theory that it's an order.
Right.
Because
that would be one of your grounds for you when you review the whole.
But what we mean by agency determination in line 6 is really final agency determination.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be because the word final agency action is used in line 4.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. As somewhat of an honest, I'm not sure I would pick that up. So much so that if I were a litigant, would say, oh, it's not bothered, I won't bother to follow that line of attack. So I suggest that maybe the word final should be put in there because I can see a lot of stuff in the opinion on the first thing.
I
don't want to say that I'm playing at
the time. Would that create any other problems with it?
No, I don't believe so.
You're going to find something open. When you have a quorum, we'll propose amendments to that. That's fine. Okay. The book becomes line 15 to 15. That's designed to keep a party from preventing the agency from making a reasoned final determination.
Correct.
Could it lead to abuse on this kind of case? The agency says, well, you can't go to court yet because although we made a decision, it's always subject to reconsideration or to further appeal to it.
Well, the process in that we had in mind when we were talking about this, specifically where an agency is required by the definition of contested case to grant an administrative hearing on a particular matter. And it was to prevent an applicant or a person who was subject to an agency order who did have a right for an administrative appeal prior to a judicial appeal to exhaust those administrative remedies.
Okay.
I don't believe the agency can take advantage of that because in the contested case provisions and in the judicial review provisions, there are time limits for reconsideration after a final order has been issued.
Okay, but this would probably be more important in a case where you have a non-contested case order. And all I want to be clear about is that the party be sufficiently aware when he or she has exhausted the administrative remedy. And I told you this, and you didn't do it, but wondered whether or not there ought to be a provision that the party can demand of the agency to know whether or not an order is a final order for purposes of appeal, or be informed in writing, so that they don't get caught in a
in the correspondence that lasts over an extended period of time, where the agency really is thinning out. Do you think that's a problem, or do you think it would be useful to have an additional provision to that effect? The person can request of the agency a statement in writing as to whether or not an order is final for purposes of the Administrative Procedure Act.
Well, if you look at page 16 of the bill, okay, now that's in a contested case.
Right, I'm concerned about the non-contested case. Jennifer, can you make a note of that? Do you see a problem with it?
I question whether I'm on 14 or 15 and use any of the language after the word action. Why can't that be deleted? Because it seems to me that by the very nature of government, you can always have further consideration.
No, the problem came from him and I can't be blinded.
Why don't you talk to Peter about the problem? And my problem again is making sure that at some point or another, you know, when finality has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And it might even be useful to consider a proceeding whereby upon request an agency shall inform the person whether an order is final for purposes of administrative judicial review. I don't know of any issue that has such a provision, but I can't see the harm in enforcing the agency.
Well, any person who's proceeding under the Administrative Procedure Act is going to be guided by the definition of contested case.
Mm-hmm.
They're not entitled to a hearing if they don't fit under one of those categories.
Yeah.
And they have an indicator right there whether what they've received is final agency action or not.
Yeah. So it's really the non-contested case orders that we're concerned about. You might want to talk to Arnie Silver about this, too, because he's done some work on non-contested case orders. It shouldn't be very difficult to clarify that one, but just his problem.
Okay, so the definition of party has been amended to re-include a semi-intervenor or limited party status. In contested cases under the current law, a person has to be a full party or nobody, and can't come in a limited status on an issue that is an individual discrete issue without being involved in the entire proceeding. And this particularly is a problem of the problem is identified in Public Utilities Commission hearings on rate making, where individual issues related to the rate making were of interest to particular parties. And those parties didn't have any desire to participate in the financial aspects of the rate-making hearing. So the committee has suggested returning the limited party status to the APA so that people who are interested in those single issues involved in larger contested cases could participate in that manner.
The time I want to emphasize this to you, because it's an extremely important definition. The definition of party controls the rights to present evidence and the rights to judicial review under the APA. And I think the committee generally concedes that a mistake was made in 77 when we abolished the category of intervenors in the wake of the Tomorrow Debt decision. The Attorney General's office at that point indicated that they were willing to see that distinction abolished, but in subsequent discussions with the judges and administrative practitioners, there was an enormous amount of worry as to whether or not you couldn't have provisions where there are more than 100 parties to a case, all of whom demand the right to present evidence, cross-examine, and so forth, and really makes the proceeding totally unwieldy. And there's further concern about who can bring a right, who can appeal a case, and whether or not that person has participated in the case and making the record is sufficient to be justified.
Again, maybe I was trying to get ahead here, but who determines the limited party status?
The agency.
Was that definition standard?
Well, the determination of who the party is really starts on line 16 on page 6. The party that's entitled under the country is the
party of the agency names it, and then you can request it in the party.
And line 20 says that the agency determines whether you
accept the agency's determination, except the judicial review after the agency gives its final order.
That was discussed by the subcommittee.
Mm-hmm.
That's the existing law, is that a person who requests to be admitted as a party and is denied that must wait until the entire proceeding has been concluded before judicial review of that question, whether they should have been involved or isn't.
It's kind of how
we talked about it. There are arguments both ways, and the committee just decided to leave it alone.
Well, what use is the limited party status if the determination is after?
Well, the agency, the argument was made by Sam Dick and Lally, the general's office last session, was that this will in fact cause the agency to admit more people as parties, because the risk of having the entire proceeding overturned on appeal will be so great that the agency will proceed with caution in denying people. The alternative is to say the agency's decision is immediately appealable. And what that does is take the risk that the agency's decision will be protracted in litigation on the issue of who are the parties, and we'll never get to decide the question of the case. But the risk of this is arguing both ways. There's policy choices, whether you know, protect the litigation or the opportunity to build the whole agency's decision.
What are the real issues here? I mean, are we back to my best situation?
Well, that case is what brought that issue before at that time, very frankly.
Although we recommended that CDC be taken out of it.
Oh, it isn't CDC now.
Yeah, but it's under the proposed bill, CDC would be accepted out.
Well, under the present law, CDC is not covered by the case that isn't the APA at all.
Okay.
And the bill would put the PUC back into the Administrative Procedure Act.
My bet was.
That was before the Energy Security Fighting Council.
Okay. So I get to tell you that.
Maybe it'll be time to go to the PUC if you want to be paid by.
Well, there's one issue before that, though.
Why did it come up in Venice?
I'm looking for the explanation in the. And then the final report of the subcommittee about why the State Board of Higher Education accepted.
We're going to get to that.
I can't find that in
there's a discussion of that in the appendix, I think.
It should be at the beginning. The subcommittee made no recommendation on whether the Board of Higher Education should receive a rulemaking exemption, but referred the question to the full Legislative Council Committee. So there should be a note at the beginning of the report discussing the Legislative Council Committee's changes in the recommendations by the subcommittee. And it could be one of the last two or three items noted in that.
Page 9, just above point 5.
So the full committee is going to recommend that the State Board of Higher Education be accepted out of what was the last now?
Well, we're going to get some
I believe it.
Why don't we hold the question for another 3 months until we get some PDC, and then we'll bring on board the person who has that concern with it. Go ahead.
Yes, Representative Fonai, my name is Tim Wood. I'm with you in the General's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the Public Utility Commission. As I understand the bill that you're considering this morning, Section 7 amends the provisions of 183.315. And what that would do is by excluding reference to the Public Utility Commission in that specific section, we now would be including the Public Utility Commission under the Administrative Procedure Act. This morning, I was only assuming that would happen, and assuming that the legislature would have adopted the way I proposed. The commissioner would like to bring before the committee his concerns. And in particular,
which commissioner is that, by the way?
Well, it's Commissioner Davis, and I think he's not sure where the decision is going to stand.
Are you going to give me a check first?
Well, let's hear what the old one said, and then we will ask Mr. Rob Bell at an appropriate point.
As the statutory scheme enacted at the present time, there is a statute dealing with appeals from commissioner's orders. That's ORS 756.580. And under that section, only parties to the commissioner's proceedings would be able to appeal the commissioner's order. Now, should the legislature put the commissioner and his orders under the Administrative Procedure Act, then the commissioner's orders are put in the Marzet decision. In that situation, where we would allow, believe that if any party or any person agrees by the order. So the impact of that is that if an individual who is a ratepayer was not a party to the proceeding, the commissioner enters an order, time for reconsideration has gone forward, and that person, even though he was not a party to the proceedings, is unhappy with the order, then he files an appeal. And he may, during that appeal, raise issues which may never have been addressed to the commissioner. And it's the commissioner's position, and it seems a very logical position, that before an individual should be able to appeal his order, then that person should have been a party to his proceedings. That person should have been able to address the issues which he is raising on appeal to the commissioner. And the commissioner should have been able to hear them for the first time in the proceedings before the commissioner. And by putting the commissioner under the APA, then we open the appeal process to any ratepayer in the state of Oregon who does not like the commissioner's order.
That's not the way I would read it, but the proposed act. It is limited party status.
Well, let's take a look at what you need to take a look at is the appeal provision of the APA.
Well, but if the commissioner were to determine that a ratepayer did not merit limited party status, then you just stated that the commissioner's view is that the party should present the case prior to the appeal.
Well, I think the first question is who has the right to appeal before the commissioner. At the present time, there's a specific statute which defines who may be parties before the commissioner. That's not in the Administrative Procedure Act, that's under the statute relating to the Public Utility Commissioner. So you have to look at 756, 525, and you'll find, I believe it's 525, and you'll find who is entitled to be a party before the commissioner. Or at least it defines who may petition to intervene. I'm not sure if I understand what this question is, Dr. Commissioner.
Well, I'm still going back to this limited party.
Okay.
That if the agency's determination is subject to judicial review after the agency has issued its final order. So if a person comes in to the ratepayer, it's assuming you could put PUC under this and says, I'd like to be a limited party, and PUC says, no, that's it. Until the whole ballgame's over, isn't it? Wouldn't that be the situation?
Well, not according to the appeal provision and not according to the Marbet decision.
Well, it's...
What you're talking
could
about,
you go to line?
We have two issues here. The first issue is, if he would be filing an appeal, the first thing he would argue is that I had a right to be a party, or I had a right to limited party status. Soon that he loses that on appeal. He may also want to address the issues that were raised in the order. And under the Administrative Procedure Act, if in fact that person could show that he is a person aggrieved or affected by the commissioner's order, even though he had been denied party status, and even though he had been denied limited party status, nevertheless, as I understand my bet, he would be able to raise those issues on appeal.
My bet,
that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interpretation of the Administrative Procedure Act as it applies to the
entity. And prior to this amendment. It would apply prior to this amendment, wouldn't it?
Well, no, so which amendment are you referring
and
to?
Prior to this bill.
That's correct.
Although this bill deals with statutory sessions which became the substance of my deposition. My bet came down in the middle of last session, mm-hmm. And we made some revisions in the ACA that these were confined by that.
So, your view is that a ratepayer can come in, ask for limited party status, could be denied, is essentially out of the process then. The ratepayer asking for limited party status would be out of the process.
He would.
Until a final order comes down. Then the ratepayer can try to get back in at that time and could appeal. First of all, his denial of limited party status, and could also appeal the order itself.
That's correct.
Now, don't you see the problem with that?
That when you're appealing both the order and your lack of status, of course, you're going to tend to look upon your lack of status as a collateral issue, and inevitably you're going to address the order itself.
a representative Steinmeier indicated what one of the arguments, what the result of that would be, is that perhaps that would encourage more participation at the proceeding level rather than to risk a reversal on appeal on the grounds that that person in fact should have been a limited party or should have been a party. And perhaps during the proceeding, that if there is any question as to a person's status, that the agency is going to err on the side of allowing individuals to come in with the hope that when they do come in, they will control the proceeding. And thus avoid that question on appeal.
But my point being that if the party is denied status, can appeal on both grounds, if it's lack of status and can appeal the order itself, it's a bit like making a special appearance and a general appearance. When you come and you make a special appearance, don't come and argue the merits of the case. Because the court will tend to say, well, you're already here on the merits of the case. You know, don't give me this nonsense about special appearance, you're already here. And they couldn't, of course, at the same time here say, don't give me this nonsense about you wanted to come in initially because you're here arguing the order as it is, instead of arguing like you could argue properly that I didn't have a right to present my evidence.
Okay, well, that would be what your point would be on appeals, if you would say to the court, by denying me party status or limited party status, let me put before the court what evidence I would have put before the commissioner for the commissioner to decide. And by the commissioner not having that evidence, then we cannot... how can he enter the order which he did? So the court would have to address that issue, because I would think the reason why you wanted to be a party is that you had something specific that you wanted to bring before the commissioner.
Oh, no, it's the reason why you wanted to be a party was that you were affected by the proposed order, not that you had any superior evidence.
Okay. Okay. Then how are you, I guess then the next question would be, how are you prejudiced on appeal? Assuming that you were denied status.
But then again, yeah. You only participate in a hearing because you have evidence.
No. Certainly, like attorneys would want to appear for the cross-examine, perhaps, to bring out evidence from witnesses who are testifying.
I want to make sure I understand something very basic to what you said. Under the present CDC hearing statute, can the only person who appeals the right to appeal be a party?
That's correct.
So you don't have the broader language that's found on page 16 of the bill, which is the scope of judicial review for the Administrative Procedure Act, which includes not only any party to any agency proceeding, but also any person adversely affected or aggrieved.
That's correct.
So I'm not sure how far your concern goes, but you're saying that the statute under which you now operate is limited to the party, which has been dedicated to the farmer. Whereas the ACA, the appeal procedure, would allow any person
and it's that specific provision which the commission is objecting to broaden the scope of the individuals who can appeal. So,
what's the policy basis of the objection? The notion that the person couldn't have a right to raise any judicial review, those things that he or she had not given the agency a fair chance to resolve within the agency?
That's correct.
Do you have an amendment proposal to us that would deal with this problem?
I do not this morning, but I suspect that I could have an amendment to the committee first thing this afternoon.
Okay, why don't you pick one up?
Okay.
That's an important policy. I don't think it ought to be submerged. I don't know whether that's something that you need to raise to your safety, such that the CDC should be entitled to that kind of treatment, or whether it's a more general problem that ought to cause us to look at whether or not the present provision that any person under the subject of abuse can appeal, irrespective of trying to participate in the agency's proceeding.
Now, I don't have further information on this other than I think if the committee would look at the Administrative Procedure Act on the federal side and would find that there is a specific exemption for rate cases before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
The language otherwise would allow any consumer in effect to bring an appeal
irrespective
of
having such a person. That's why I said I hesitate even to mention, but I would suspect that they specifically exempt certain provisions of the Federal Administrative Procedure Act from the rate making process. And it would be, because of the uniqueness, because of the, I would wonder if we characterize a rate case unlike a, many contested cases are very few facts actually involved in the rate case. Most of the decisions are actually policy decisions. And which the courts have characterized as legislative decisions rather than judicial decisions. And thus, the federal agencies have decided to limit the individuals who can actually appeal that because they want to. But I'm not sure. I guess I should withdraw until I have
an
opportunity to
look at that. Well, but we could do it one of two ways, I suppose, maybe even more. One, we could give you a specific exemption, but bring it as some broader definition we can appeal to. Secondly, we could go a step beyond that and say you need litigation proceedings, whether it's not giving a PVC special service, but it's rather sending out a generic kind of proceeding as to which that kind of appeal is inappropriate. Well, we could say we're bringing in, we're going to take the lump just in the other agency with respect to the existing standing requirements. And I think that's an issue we'll have to present to the full committee.
Okay. Could you kind of refresh my mental state of law is 2 days of bar review, which may be all right. As to the difference in the order and rule, I think it's relevant here to raise.
Right.
An order being a specific judicial
under the federal
rule being broad.
In the federal series, rate-making is defined as rulemaking. So it's handled under the informal notice and comment procedure, unless the federal statute requires that it be done under formal trial type procedure. In the state APA, though, there is no exception for it. There's no definition of rate-making as rulemaking. So rate-making has been handled as contested case by the agency trial, as you say,
in order?
Requiring it, yes. The outcome of the rates are embodied in an order.
Isn't there a kind of a public policy trade-off where you talk about if it's rules and notice requirements are not extinguishing however, on the other hand, if it's a rule, the party status, you definitely can party if you don't have that. So
in rulemaking, you give notice to the world, but have less
regulations.
In a judicial proceeding, the notice is limited to parties. But then you have very elaborate potential safeguards in the determination of the exact
So I take your position to be that you want it to be the best world is what you have.
No, I don't think that's fair characterization. The PDC already has an adversary, a rigorous adversary proceeding for determination rate, but they do it under the PDC's own generic statute. Now, they would be brought, if the bill passed in study form, under a proceeding which is substantially similar in terms of the procedural safeguards that are given, but with an judicial review for this, has a much broader provision for who can challenge what the agency did in the adjudicatory proceeding, to the extent that a person who wasn't even a party to the proceeding can now bring an appeal. That, I guess, is the case.
That's the major concern, that's correct.
Are you saying then that a rate is more like an order or more like a rule?
It's an order.
Doesn't it affect a pretty large class of people?
That's correct.
And that sounds more like a rule to me.
Well, actually, it affects, in a sense, it does affect a large range, but actually, it only affects one, the company. And your rates are going to go up, but yeah.
That doesn't affect me?
It does affect you, that's right. It does. I'm not sure how does the legislature characterize it. The courts have characterized the commissioner's action as legislative. So we can analogize it closer. Yeah,
so you want to go back more towards order characterization?
Well, I think what we're concerned about is not who do we give notice to, who is before the hearing, but who has the opportunity to appeal. That's the concern we have.
Yeah, is there concern about just these ordinary ratepayers, how you might appeal?
That's right. If they did not participate in the proceedings, did not raise their issues at the time that the hearings were scheduled, then it seems that under normal appellate practice that we attempt to give the lower tribunal an opportunity to rule on an issue before it's raised on appeal. And it seems to be a good rule. And it's a rule that has worked in the past before with the commissioner as it's presently enacted, prohibiting those to only individuals who are parties to the appeal. And that's what we want to say, to limit it to only people who were parties at the initial proceeding.
Because utility rate making cases are, a peculiar case in the sense that you don't we need to have some aspect both of rulemaking, to notice to everyone and some memo like participation. And the requirement of detailed fact finding can only be done in a more tightly controlled atmosphere. I'm not sure that either of the models, you have a bifurcated model in the state board, which is either your rulemaking or your adjudicating a contested case. And we haven't really moved to the kind of a hybrid model that's coming into the new federal state
The race controversy is a result not so much of race per se, but of the other issues involved.
I'm not sure.
Well, it's maybe the product of that old public power versus private power.
Oh, sure.
It's a part of that, it's part of nuclear versus non-nuclear. And I sometimes get the feeling that it's the whipping boy of both of those.
Yeah, but it presents an interesting question as to where and when and what circumstances members of the public get to participate in the system. And with Ben Richards comes to present their public insistence, what they want to do is bring along a couple of hundred of their friends and blow off steam or make a policy argument against utility, but do not want to be admitted. They have to have counsel present at the rest of the 100 hours of proceeding that don't deal with a particular point that they want to address. And that the present structure as it is, doesn't easily accommodate that kind of
issue. I should represent, if I may, I'll just submit then to the committee this afternoon a proposal of amended language. Which
I might propose to cover a couple of different options. Number one, all written procedures. Number two, a specific extension of the CDC proposed language in terms of appeals from late misinterpretation and limiting that to party status. Beyond that, I would like to provide the federal law in this
statement.
If I could give preferably the quotation of the law. And I think that combination is quite right that in order to give the community a little bit more security, if you can possibly touch basis against the law bill.
Okay. I think that he had been conferred with, and I think this is his position that I.
One another committee had a terrible experience of the new commissioner disassociating herself from the prior commissioner's bills and everything else. It's been quite an experience that committee. A lot of orphan bills down there.
Well, let's see if we can find a father for this.
If you just passed over the Department of Higher Education issue, I guess, because we ran from Section 5 to Section 7, so why don't we go back to Section 6 now, since Stansfield and Mr. Thomas came up and join you on either side of it. The issue before us is a question that the subcommittee took no position on, which was a partial exemption or clarification of what activities the Department of Higher Education has to rule. And the full committee voted to allow a deduction of this provision in the text of the proposed language. So everyone can read off and walk us through.
I'm Ed Branch, the Assistant Attorney General assigned to Higher Education, and I'm speaking on behalf of Higher Education today. On page 7, lines 7 through 13, is the amendment that we requested make it clear that, first, that academic matters do not require rulemaking procedures, that standards for establishing fees other than general tuition, residence hall, and housing charges. There are many charges which may have a local or one institution or very limited application, and it's extremely difficult and time-consuming and cumbersome to comply with rulemaking in all of those fees. And then, in addition, charges for symposiums and short courses and conferences, which frequently are requested by businessmen or by others in a particular area, and those are intended to pay for their own costs. Prices of food, books, retail goods, things like that, athletic events, concerts, we're asking to be exempted on those because, again, it's just not feasible to to set those fees far enough in advance. It takes better than 2 months for the Board of Higher Education to adopt a rule, and an institution, and the board has delegated authority to the institution through the president of the institution to adopt rules,
Now, they can move more rapidly than that, but it still takes quite a little time, and you just don't have the time to do it. And again, it's cumbersome. This is something that we have discussed and rediscussed with the students on a number of occasions, and I think Mr. Chalmers in this case has some concern about one portion of this proposal, but in general, I don't think that there's any opposition to this. One of the things that we did submit to the subcommittee during the interim at his request was a bill based on the state of Washington law, which exempts higher education completely and sets up an APA solely for the higher education system. We did not recommend that. The committee thought that not to recommend it. The reason we didn't recommend it, we didn't think it was advisable or even sensible to set up two totally separate APAs, such as they've done in the state of Washington. Insofar as complying with contested case procedures are concerned, there's no greater burden on higher education than any other agency, and the contested case procedures we can live with. So that it boiled down to we simply asked for a partial exemption from rulemaking authority. Mr. Chairman, I do have a few additional comments I'd like to make, and if you prefer, I can make them later, and it might be appropriate then for Mr. Chalmers to express his views on this.
I think we just can hit this time for us right now.
Okay.
Let
me say, generally, I think the committee did an excellent job in drafting this bill. I'm not talking about any provisions that apply specifically to one agency other than higher education because I'm not familiar with them. But insofar as you made changes in the APA, I think you've done a very excellent job. I think that there will be less, if this bill passes in substantially this form, I think there will be a lot less failure to comply because it's more understandable. The procedures are more clearly spelled out. I think you've done a good job. Now, I do have a few little questions about it. If I knew everybody else in the room as well as I do you, perhaps I would say that on page 5, we'll comply with the requirement to use plain, simple English whenever the legislature starts complying with Article 4, Section 21. But I don't know everybody else that well, Dave, so I won't say that.
That's the provision that requires that the legislature write
That's right.
In plain, understandable language. That's a fair provision.
On page 6, at the top of page 6, sub 4A says, order means any final agency action expressed orally or in writing. But at the bottom of page 7, line 37, it says an order is not final until it's reduced to writing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a conflict there.
Yes, it is. It's really right.
Now, I have a problem insofar as higher education is concerned, and there are some other state agencies I think will have the same problem with the amendment on page 6, lines 34 and 35. Action by agencies directed to other agencies which do not substantially affect the interests of the public. There is a provision at the top of line, page 8, lines 2 and 3. Any officer or employee to whom rulemaking authority is delegated under this section is an agency. The Board of Higher Education delegates to the president the authority to adopt rules. Therefore, they are state agencies. And of course, the Health Division and then the Human Resources Agency and undoubtedly some other agencies do have sub agencies, so they delegate rulemaking authority. Well, now, taking those two things together and identifying, talking about higher education, if the board directs a president to take action, a particular type of action, how do we know whether that substantially affects the interest of the public? In other words, they're talking to a sub-agency. If we were dealing with another agency outside of higher education, I don't think I'd have too much problem with it. But I think I do have a problem with it, insofar as it affects the president and the institutions in the Department of Higher Education. And I don't know how to determine whether it substantially affects the interest of the public. And I doubt that that's what was intended. It may be
that we should put an exception in there to action by an agency directed to a subject. I don't know. I did that to the committee for whatever it's worth.
Ed, I'm not sure. Are you saying that you don't want the delegation of authority inadvertently to be thought itself to require rulemaking procedures?
Well, no. It's important to tell the president to do something. Perhaps, I'll try to take a good example at the moment, but the board now tells me that the money's not coming along, but that's what can't happen. And the board tells the president to tighten up and save the $1 million. That affects, certainly affects the public, affects the students directly, and the public indirectly. Is that a rule, then? But must that be adopted as a rule? But normally, you say, well, that's just simply a direction to a subordinate, and it would be an order or an internal management directive that would not do something that would be adopted as a rule. So I'm a little troubled as to how, when this might be applied and how this is. Everything that the board says to a president, does that have to become a rule? I don't know.
Okay. All right.
And then I wonder if I can ask that whether I have correctly interpreted a provision, on page 8, the new language, line 29 through 32. And I think I understand it, but it took me half the morning yesterday. And then only because somebody asked the question that I thought at the moment was stupid, but realized it wasn't. An agency, in every way, was a situation where an agency plans to adopt a rule on a certain date, and it has published its notice in the bulletin, and it notified everybody else that it's real good as well. Then it gets requests for this from 10 or more people. So it must hold a hearing then. Now, I think the new language says that the agency can then hold a hearing without republication in the bulletin, but upon notice to everybody that the rule calls that to notify, except the Secretary of State. So that's the interpretation.
Yeah, the problem comes up this way, and we could have dealt with it in a different way, and I'm not sure how agencies are handling it now. But let's assume an agency chooses not to give notice of its intended action, but doesn't think that the rule is controversial, mm-hmm. and so does not give notice of a public hearing, which it has the option not to do. And then on day 14, one day before the rule would otherwise go into effect, a person makes a request for a hearing which the agency then must give. Mm-hmm. The question then arises, do they have to wait till the next cycle of Secretary of State for it and go out and thus delay the further action on the rule until official notice has been given that way? Or is there some more truncated way they can give notice to those persons who are actually concerned about it that the public hearing has been requested and we will now hold it next Tuesday or Wednesday? So this procedure is designed, if I remember our discussion, to allow the agency to hold that hearing without going through the entire notification procedure again in the event of any question.
Well, that's what I thought was meant, and I have no problem with that.
Is my memory correct on that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The tag end language says, other than a requirement in order to give them the bulletin, as I said,
probably
several others, but
for a little while, actually. Well, I think that's the one that says that the agency non-notice rules say we give notice in every case by putting it through the board.
Yeah.
Then they have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If they bound themselves, they have to follow their rules.
Well, okay, I guess we did come up with the same conclusion you did, what it means, and so I'm comfortable with that. There's one other provision.
For what it's worth, I'm just as much of a newcomer to this language as you. And I think I can speak to all of the newcomers, but it's pretty hard to read. And it's, maybe think about it.
Maybe you'll learn something more about it.
The other provision I'd like to mention is on page 21, lines 15 and 16. That provision was included in a draft of the bill that we submitted to the Legislative Council Committee during the interim. It was submitted not because we wanted it, but not because the Association wanted it, but because we were requested to include that. Higher education was preferred to that provision. Higher education lived with it. Incidentally, I do not know who requested it. The request due to the attorney today is that I have a daughter who made that request. Now, I don't think it's a problem, and when I say I don't think it's a problem, I realize that somebody could disagree with that.
Pardon me.
Yeah.
Since it says that the State Board of Higher Education itself promulgated rules governing the transfer of academic credits from other institutions, and other institutions within the state system, or other, all others?
Well, this would be all others.
Okay, you maintain there is no problem as to the transfer of academic credits?
Yes.
Suppose no problem between Portland State and Louisville?
I don't think there is.
All right, well, I'm just about ready to disagree with you, but no. Are the rules governing the transfer of academic credits from other institutions standardized now between all state system higher education schools?
They're not completely.
Well, maybe that's the reason for this, for this rule right here, because that's the situation that some of us have run into, that what's good at one institution is not good at another institution, the concept being that if you come in from, let's say, Texas Tech with an English comp, and you've got, and you've always going to give you 3 hours, there's no reason why Portland State shouldn't give you 3 hours, that we don't need any more of this academic snobbery that goes on about we're better than so-and-so, we're not going to take. Usually the better the school in its own eyes, the less credit it accepts from an outside institution, unless it happens to be Harvard or Berkeley. That's what this rule seems to me to be right on point.
Well, you may find problems in individual cases, and it's so important to find them no matter what the board rule says.
Are you telling me that we can change our, we can institute this statute, and that the board is going to go on in its own happy way regardless of what we do?
That is not what I said.
No.
May I be permitted to proceed and explain what I'm talking about? It's a problem I have lived with for quite a few years. I was on the interim committee, 63 to 65, education committee, and at that time there was a great cry about transfer of community college credits to higher education. We were very concerned about that. We felt that great progress was made during that interim in overcoming that, and I really think that progress has been made since then. Now, this is a book that's published every year by higher education. It's brought to date every year. It's not a two-page pamphlet that runs 143 pages. This is made available to all community colleges and any other college that wants it. It's a current transfer program that shows what the requirements are of each institution in higher education for admission for transfer from community college. And this really is the only place where there's any general problems, because that's my knowledge. And this, I think, has been largely overcome by the cooperation between the community colleges and higher education in the last 12 or so years. That up to 108 credits can be accepted from community colleges. That would be 18 credit hours per term or per term, that's a year. 186, I think, is also required for graduation from the college within the Department of Higher Education. Now, this points out what each college requires for transfer into that college, that also contains an alphabetical listing of programs in higher education, that open to nursing, law enforcement, journalism, engineering technology, and so on, that lists exactly what credits and what courses will be accepted by higher education. There are some courses that are taken in community colleges and undoubtedly some other colleges that are not accepted. For instance, technical courses that are given in community colleges frequently are not accepted. Two exceptions to that are OIT and Oregon State University. Reasons are that those two institutions have technical types of courses where the technical courses some other community colleges fit in. But, of course, in auto repair, for instance, it would not be any good in a liberal arts course at the University of Oregon or another liberal arts institution. It wouldn't have much to do with teacher training. But if the courses are relevant, they're accepted. Now, the board put out the rule. I hope it wouldn't have to be as extensive as this, But if it's going to do a good job with it, it's going to have to be a pretty specific rule. I would point out one other thing. If we adopt the rule, then it must be complied with. I'm constantly telling higher education, you adopted that rule, you must live with it, whether you like it or not. You've got to live with it or change it. Sometimes it's inconvenient to comply with your own rule, but nonetheless, it must be done. If we adopt the rule, then the flexibility is going to be gone from this, and you're going to find that the rule will be applied frequently to the detriment of a student who has a particular problem. Now, I'm not going to say that every time a student has a particular problem, it's decided in favor of the student, but more often than not it is. So that if a rule is adopted, the flexibility for the system will be gone. And some students are not going to be able to get into higher education who otherwise would. If the legislature and keep this in the bill and pass it, we'll live with it. Higher education will comply with it. It'll adopt the rule. But frankly, I don't think that rule would serve anybody. There is a climate of cooperation between higher education institutions and the community colleges and the private colleges in the state. And that higher education will continue to work towards whether this passes or whether it doesn't. But we do urge that this be released from the bill.
But the time would be coming better if you have some other.
Okay.
Is that all that you
That's
want
all
to
I
comment
have.
On
no.
In your future?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Don.
Chairman, I'm Don Chalmers. I'm with the Office of Student Advocacy at the University of Oregon. Office of Student Advocacy at the University. I'd like not to speak on behalf of either organization in the comments today. The provision of Section G on page 7, exempting rulemaking in certain areas of higher education, is a throwback to a bill that was tabled last session in the Senate. It is, however, an amended form of that bill, providing for a less exemption than was presented last time. We certainly applaud the effort to limit the exemption for any agency from the rulemaking area. However, there are still some areas that are included in that exemption, which is better served by actually going through rulemaking. You can understand the desire to exclude the standard advisors that are student unions from rulemaking procedures. You can also understand the desire to exempt the cost of doing a particular concert. But we cannot understand the exemption for standards for admission, for example, saving policies, or establishing fees other than general tuition, residence calls, and housing charges. The overall balance involved in providing for rulemaking is that the agency's convenience must be considered, but we believe is more important. Factor is giving the public an opportunity to respond and offer testimony regarding a particular policy or rule established by an agency. We're not talking about a particular hearing in this instance. We're talking about an agency delegated responsibility for overall coordination of the actual educational efforts to reach at the higher education level across the state. And if we are to assume that the standards for admission, for example, which will determine whether or not an individual can enter one of our institutions higher learning, is not no longer to be open to public inquiry, I think we've made a great mistake. Academic advancement also is an area where, in terms of the extending of the degrees, the public has an interest that should be heard, at least in some form of hearing. Now, I think that,
standards for admission, academic advancement. But what do you understand by the term academic advancement? What sorts of standards would those be?
Those would be standards for the advancement through, say, the degrees offered by institutions, requirements for majors, departmental majors within the university itself, questions having to do with the exam of post-baccalaureate and graduate degrees.
What is that in general understanding what terms I guess you term academic advancement?
The first portion of this, is really exclusively a matter of academic freedom. The faculty members make these determinations as to who's eligible for admission, who's eligible for promotion, what the degree requirements would be, and so on.
On the other hand, I
suggest that the standards for admission are areas of consent of the board and have had some action by the board in the past.
I've often wondered about this, John, let me ask you this thing. I worried a hell of a lot when I was the legal counsel to president about what the faculty did within the area of statutory responsibility. And the faculty, and actually the students on the faculty, when the faculty senate, they knew that somebody was met.
would make decisions on what courses should be added or dropped. The faculty traditionally have to approve the list of graduating seniors in order for you to get the degree. Whether ROTC should be kept or abolished, whether or not physical education should be a requirement. Those are matters which have always been decided as a matter of faculty legislation. They've received an enormous amount of publicity locally on the campus, and they have received an enormous amount of debate among the various elements of the campus community. And to my knowledge, the university has never given notice to rule legislation to have a faculty meeting, because the theory is it's not the university administration, which is part of the theory, it's the faculty. Now, as far as I'm concerned, giving APA notice under those circumstances is completely redundant, because the institutional procedures themselves guarantee really probably more participation than the APA would. But what would be your view of, if the findings were to be accepted at all, of modifying it to say that in any instance where institutional procedures require decisions to be made by the faculty or family faculty students in these areas, departmental majors, et cetera, that would allow you to be exempt from the additional burden that APA requires?
Well, I think one of the problems, Dave, is that we're going to talk to anybody in the specific statute providing for specific authority to the faculty at the University of Oregon versus the overall statute involving the APA and speaking to the agency and their responsibilities. We look to the 351 language that sets out things for the university charter, special powers to the faculty. There may be some interplay there that we're able to find, and perhaps we better provide for an exception in this area. For example, in the area where the faculty is taking a responsibility under the 351 language, that the rulemaking requirements not be carried out. That's a possibility. But what I'd like to see
could
is...
Could you live with that?
I believe it could live with at least the faculty meeting aspect. So the problem, when you filter down into the, say, the departmental decision-making, for example, in terms of admission to their own program, one of the things I mentioned earlier is the question of trying to maintain some sort of discretion among the departments. But again, when you're talking about general policy, that a policy that has applicability to all people who apply for, say, a PhD candidacy in political science, we're not talking in that instance about academic freedom, we're talking about access to a program sponsored and funded by the state of Oregon. And in that instance, there ought to be an opportunity at least to have it publicly heard. Now, another problem with your model of allowing the faculty to continue in its normal decision-making process is that members of the general public are not necessarily allowed to participate in the discussion. That is, that those members of the faculty who are voting members and members of the student association who have been elected to the Student University Affairs Board, as 18 members, have speaking privileges and voting privileges on for the faculty. But there is not a provision within the university rules that I'm aware of that would allow a person from off the street to come in and say, we're making a decision about academic admission requirements, and I'd like to comment about that.
Well, here's the problem. Of course, the faculty has committees on, say, revising student conduct code. Typically, that's been done through a student faculty committee that has hearings, and anyone can speak there, although when the code is debated, that's done particularly in the faculty meeting, because the university faculty for 120 years has been delegated authority to make that kind of decision. We should require APA compliance so that somebody, and I don't know who the hell it would be, has to give additional notice to the administrative rule bulletin and the opportunity for public participation. Can we do anything but rubber stamp the decision faculty made anyway, because they have no statutory authority to be part from it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in that case, APA compliance is now redundant in this case, essentially trying to continue to know that.
Yeah. Well, I think that again has to back to the interplay of powers that have been assigned level expected to university faculty specifically. And that may not be the case on the other campuses where the authority of the faculty is completely different than it is at the university.
No, I know. If the administration makes all those decisions, I say that you're an agency and you're just like any other agency, it's just government.
Mm-hmm.
But where you have a different structure that's really designed for the academic world, you've been in effect for more than 100 years. I wonder if that specific statutory authority is here, whether there shouldn't be some deference paid to it, because that's the way censorship policies are coming along.
I would say that it would make it feel more palatable to the opposition. But I would also suggest that in terms of the State Board of Higher Education making determinations in this area, that clearly we prefer to retain the ranking authority and responsibility in the areas that have outlined.
Okay, one more
thing. I would suggest that we would not oppose any language from the language starting with subject to symposiums and continuing throughout the rest of the language. Language part of that time, I think, requires study treatment by the committee, and there's a concern that the language and the standards for admission, academic advancement, grading policy, academic credit, graduation, abandonment of degrees, scholarship, and similar academic matters especially when the activity is being taken on by the assistant executive or the State Board of Higher Education, to remain a responsibility of essential rulemaking procedures. That's a great danger in looking to any agency and stepping them from rulemaking and indicating that the argument is very cumbersome, for example, for the agency, because the clear trade-off, as I mentioned before, in maintaining an agency and allowing them to make rules that have the force of law is that there is an opportunity for public comment and public input.
Because I guess my problem is not with cumbersomeness. You can make rules by boilerplate, and you can train over a period of time clerical staff to do most of the filings and follow the checklist.
The problem that I see, and I hear constantly from people in higher education, is their concern that they're going to get wrong as to when something fits within some matter of academic policy fits within the broad definition of rulemaking. There are so many, there's so much minutiae that arguably is a rule because there's no exemption for it, but yet doesn't really excite any substantial interest or opposition, that in order to sanitize it necessary for rulemaking, really creates the problem of the existing of the peril.
Well, I think that
someone down the line is going to challenge it, and all of a sudden you've got nothing.
Yeah, I guess I'm suggesting that there are agencies, there are probably other agencies in the same position, who have to deal with the question of whether or not the action they're taking is a rule, or promulgating a rule, and I have a complete confidence in the staff of higher education that they can make a good fair split in their area. And I don't think that exempting them from rulemaking is the appropriate way to handle that problem.
Well, I'm not certain by all the things that are spelled out here. In fact, that's why the subcommittee made a recommendation on it altogether. You certainly put tuition, residence hall, and housing charges would not be exempted. In any of that. Those are things that clearly people have very big interest in.
Well,
grading policy, that is more of a question. If a school wants to go and add pluses and minuses, ought it have to go through a statewide procedure for notice? Yes, it has a local procedure that basically involves the effective community anyway.
Yeah, maybe I'm going to be considered. If I could make one comment on Ed's advisory transfer setting, and if there's any nation who's concerned about that, I don't have strong feelings and directions because one way or the other about that, but I think it's important to understand that at the university at least, there is a person assigned in the admissions office who sits and listens to people tell a story about what this particular course meant and whether or not it's acceptable. And so there's a real ad hoc type decision in that regard, saying, well, English 503 from Stuttgart University is in neighborhood, but 473 biology from Tanzania does. Okay, so what I would suggest is that if you're talking about the State Board of Higher Education providing some general standards regarding transfer of credit, you may find some friction created by that, and you can find some unhealthy friction created because you now force inquiry about what is good enough from Blue Mountain Community College and not good enough from Lane Community College, for example. But I would suggest that one way to handle that problem would be to provide for an exception policy at the local institution where the institution desires to allow the credit, but not an exception to the general policy created by the State Board of Higher Education where they deny the credit, so that the institution could go one step beyond the policy if they determined that they wanted to give that individual student credit, but they could not go outside of the general policy of the State Board of Higher Education if they said, no, we won't take that credit. That would give the local institution some flexibility in aiding the student, as Ed's talking about, and completing their program.
You allow leniency at the lower
institutional level, where they have to make some pretty hard choices about allowing credit for the two-part science course or the English course and not the Tanzanian biology course. But I would think that there would be an advantage in having the State Board of Higher Education make some statements about what it has as a system to look to for the purpose of, statements outside of those reproduced from the institutions themselves about what is best in terms of transfer credit. In other words, when the State Board of Higher Education was created in 1929, one of the purposes was to provide for some continuity amongst the institutions so they would not be competing amongst each other for students, nor would they be competing against each other for other academic policies. And so I think it's maybe an area where the committee will want to at least look into a way that allows the board to create clear policy direction in this area, at the same time allows local institutions to make exceptions that benefit students.
Well, your description of the way it occurs is my recollection, strong recollection of the way it occurs too. That faithless clerk somewhere in the admissions office deciding a substantial question goes to your individual academic life, if not life itself, in the sense that, back when I was in the school, they still had the draft, it could be life itself. But as to whether or not she did or did not make the patent, it could be offered out there.
John, would you provide to the committee an alternative statement of sub G? We might try to work into that. And this is an issue I want to take to the full committee. You might work in language except in the exercise of authority to think of statute by the university faculty.
I think that's different.
Elizabeth, have you considered that?
That's it.
And then I do have a note. I think I understood what Mr. Banfield's problem was on that agency question. I should just give you this note on my
point. Okay.
Do
you see any problem conforming the language and suggesting
No.
Okay, why don't you prepare a language that you get to that?
Okay.
My favorite administrator back there.
Yes, that's simple.
You have to do the rotation.
What?
Just, you want to rotate anything in here?
Oh, no.
It's
down the office, I say, base office. And I'd like to comment on that. Require a monthly publication, you have to sometime publish two bulletins a month, first and 15th. We bring up your attention for consideration in considering this statement of need to publish.
Dennis, I don't follow the reason. If the statement of need would need to be published, then I do follow that it would greatly increase the size,
right?
But it would increase the size whether you publish once a year or 15 times a year. Why would you have to increase the number of publications?
For these times, because when I had very difficult time making the schedule on the first and 15th, we had cutoff times, for instance, on the 20th of the preceding month for the first and following month. So, when quite honestly, the brain goes right up to your day. If you double the size of both of them, we would then indirectly increase our three times. You may not be paying the same cutoff, but maybe not publish until the middle of the month. Second thing would be
the
figure of
examining
that
many
pieces of paper.
Yeah, but if there's plenty more material over it's going to be covered. Sooner or later he's going to have to get it put together. If you double his load on a monthly basis, it's still a double load, but you cut it in half and probably just
keep
working in
life.
Okay.
Well, that's
a
reason. Well, supposing you had a provision in here, I'm just thinking out loud, that said where the length of the document exceeds 20 certain length set by rule, if the agency doesn't really set it out, then the notice publishes that they're faithful, although it would still have to include the statement of need and notice of the terms of parties, and otherwise it's part of the notice rule.
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate. I think also in the notice provision that a reference can be made that the statement of need is available.
But what we want to do, frankly, was say it doesn't do anybody any good if the statement of need is buried in the agency's office. There ought to be some requirement that statement is more widely disseminated. And ideally, it ought to be in the bulletin in every case.
I'm not understanding that, Kevin. I'm not arguing that we should have said it. I'm just alerting you to the possibility that we may not physically be able to continue publishing a bulletin twice a month. And I don't want you or any member of this committee to have to 2497 going for fact, to blindsided by the fact, and maybe chastised by some of your associates. When we determine that we can't physically accommodate it, handling the bulletin twice a month. It's something that we project and we perceive. We certainly have a great way to avoid that, but that estimation that the bulletin will minimally double in size on the state of need. Some of the state of need that are office are longer than the rule itself. So it's just into the quantity of just the ability to handle it. And we just want to be aware that this is a possibility.
Well, you might think if you're that concerned about it, of some language which would give some discretion to the state's office to refer by reference without exempting out as a matter of course all the statements of need.
Oh,
all
right. Section 12 permits the agency to stop all or part of the attorney general's not ruled by compliance. Do you think that's an improvement?
Where are you now?
Excuse me, section 12.
What would you suggest to be the amount of the bulletin?
Well, I don't have any objection to it, except that we have...
I think it's good, you're putting out twice a month, but is there any...
People are accustomed to that information, and the custom changes, you know, obviously from Claire, and this is on your tag, for the reason
The law now requires monthly, you on bi-monthly.
Right.
But what you really do, Tom, is a substantial increase the length of time to quite a bit before rules that they intend to promulgate can actually be promulgated. They would lose at least 15 days.
That's another fact. The agencies now are always losing that their material on it. They can only do it once a month or twice a month to lose 15 days.
Which would I add? What it would do, I'm sure, is increase the number of temporary rule filings. Because if you need to get a rule in effect, you can't have that, you have a further 2 week timeline, probably file a temporary rule, which does not require publication. Like poking a balloon, what goes in one side comes out the other.
I'm lazy, but that's probably the extent of what I can decide by 37 months without what you do. I don't
want to
do it. I just
want to
let you know.
Let me ask you this. From purely from your standpoint and, putting together, forgetting all the other rounds, is 30 monthly or it sounds like 180 days from all that.
No, I don't do it twice a month. And I say that in all sincerity, because I think that at 15 days, I know from an election administration point of view, 15 days make a heck of a difference. Also a problem of adopting temporary rules and turning around and adopting permanent rules. You've got two things to blow it. And I particularly don't like that. So I would like to do something.
Do we address issues of temporary rules in here?
Yeah. Section 13, referencing the voluminous material in a rule is something that is done quite often at this time. And what we can see is we don't change our operation. Section 16, this is the hot button for us, if you will. We have, over the period of the last 2 years, done a great length to provide as near complete publication of the OAR as we can accomplish in these 2 years. We are within about a half a dozen agencies of having a complete publication. We have also converted and shifted to the oldest process, and will, in the very near foreseeable future, add probably over 100 agencies to share the process.
Okay.
I don't know what the acronym means, but it's the same thing with website counseling, which is the key words that type of thing.
Just the WordPress now.
I tried to figure that one out, but in any case, we feel that by having the ability to prescribe form and style, and it would be our intention at this point of providing the same form and style as used for bills and measures of innovation and legislative sessions, it would greatly reduce the amount of workload that we require to, that we are experiencing right now. We would project without this capability that our production workload would be hampered. We could see that with this team, and this is based mostly on a study made by the oldest people here in the state capital, that if we have this capability, there would be a 64% reduction in our production requirements, and that we would require bracketing and underscoring, or I'm kind of sizing it to 3.3. It may seem like a small item to you, but it frankly saves us money by retuning an entire rule than it does to sit there and try to figure out what sentence or what two or three words that changed. And oftentimes that is all that was changed when a rule is amended or changed the way it is amended. But it comes to us as an interpretation which we refuse to make, and it comes to us as unidentifiable. We talked to the subcommittee during the interim, and Section 16, quite honestly, I believe, was in there at our request. And we just really want to encourage you to see if that cannot remain. It would be very helpful to the system and allow us to get the rest of the OAR on during this coming biennium. We could actually bring in the entire rule within the compilation, essentially within reasonable reach of the major agencies.
Yes, sir. Did you say the rule of the agency? Do you believe that the agency rule that is a group just all in front of the back.
You're asking for that sort of comment. Do you have any basis for I believe that they can follow a form of style because it's something that is easily understood, and I think some of the attorneys can handle the formatting problem for them. Frankly, the problem we have is the problem we have right now is you have people out there who don't know what they're doing. And they follow rules. I mean, if that's not asking, that's absolutely right. Would we improve with them? Yes. For the simple fact that right now, Secretary of State has no authority to reject the filing on any basis at all. And quite honestly, we get some very interesting phone calls from attorneys and practitioners who live with the OAR saying, you know, this is pretty dumb. Why did you put it in the publication? The truth is, I don't know control of it. We were looking for an instigation to give us some monitoring capability. This is the one. We took it back to you. You would not be able to adopt the order. It's that kind of thing. That's what we were looking for. Those are my comments. I'm going to try to take one of them.
Kevin, you have some comments?
This matter that the Federal Department of Justice usually recommends the Department of Justice. I'm sitting here trying to figure out what the rulemaking changes are. But I also listened to Ed's comment about this. It's a possible conflict order not to file on full judicial writing on page 67. Reading this thing over, it seems to me that three things. On page 6, you've got a final agency action, that's one thing. Then you've got an order, and then you've got a final order. There's no definition in the thing of final order. And then you refer to the term final order throughout the bill. For example, on page 6, line 22, after the agency has issued a final order. On page 16, with respect to appeal, you cannot appeal judicially anything except the final order. So, and yet there's no definition of final order, there's a definition of order, but they're not the same thing. I think possibly the solution is to take the language out of page 7, line 37, and put a definition of final order, meaning that it's an order which is reduced to writing. Now, that may or may not do it, but at least it clarifies in my mind that order is one thing, final agency act is another thing, and final order has a very significant legal meaning. It's not the time. And if you talk about an order being an oral determination, that's how it feels. What you're talking about is a final order is a written order, and that becomes appeal. Anyway, that's my thought.
Okay, so thank you for coming. Anyone else can we probably see here on this bill? Okay, we will during the hearing carry the bill to the full committee at the committee. I appreciate you. Thanks a lot.